may be seated.
When you see Joanne, would you give her my best?
Good morning. We're on case 12-1924 and 13-300 in the matter of State XREL, the Cincinnati Inquirer versus the Honorable Robert H. Lyons. Sitting in this morning is Judge Lisa Sadler from the, the 10th District Court of Appeals in place of Justice Kennedy.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Jack Greiner, and I represent the Cincinnati Inquirer in these matters. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please. Your Honors, my son was sworn into the bar yesterday, and I raised that only because it allowed me the privilege of listening to Justice O'Connor's remarks to the incoming lawyers that talked about the standards that are expected of us as lawyers. I would propose that there are standards for judges as well. And among those standards are that if records of a court proceeding that are, by their very nature, public, are going to be put out of the public's view, that that be done sparingly and that it be done in conformance with the statutory authority that allows it to happen. In these cases, that standard was not met. Specifically,
well, isn't the argument it wasn't, you were correct, and now it is?
Your Honor, you're speaking with respect to case 2012, and particularly that matter that involved a proceeding that took place on November 7th of 2012, where a conviction was immediately sealed, not pursuant to any hearing, but essentially by agreement of the prosecutor and defense counsel.
And ultimately, the judge agreed it didn't do it right.
Right, and it was sealed pursuant to the wrong statute.
Right.
However, to fix that, I do not believe the fix was executed properly, and in fact, I think it raises significant issues for this court, and that is in large reason why we're here. The parties got together on December 13th of 2012, and again, in order to fix this problem, again, agreed to a proceeding that I think raises serious issues, troubling issues about accountability and accessibility to records. The parties agreed that the defendant, who had been convicted and had paid his fine for disorderly conduct, would be permitted to withdraw his plea, at which point the prosecutor then decided that they were no longer interested in prosecuting this case, and then the record was sealed pursuant to 29-53-52, and ostensibly properly. Again, the previous sealing order post-conviction was done pursuant to the statute that applies to acquittals or dismissals of the proceeding. The problem here is that there was no basis by which that guilty plea should have been permitted to be withdrawn. The Rule 32, Criminal Rule 32, permits the withdrawal of a guilty plea after the imposition of sentence only to avoid manifest injustice. And the purported manifest injustice to be avoided here was to honor the agreement that had been made between the prosecutor and the defense counsel that the record would be sealed.
But counsel, is that a right that your client can enforce?
We believe that an improperly granted expungement is subject to collateral attack, and we cited the Lettingham case in our briefs and the Irv v. Coe case as well. So we believe that this is part and parcel of a procedure to improperly seal a record. And we do believe that we have standing, and we believe that we can collaterally attack it in this proceeding. We have no other way to address the issue. The manifest injustice, of course, again, going back to that point, allegedly is that, well, there was an agreement that the record was going to be sealed, and now the record can't be sealed, it turns out. So we have to allow the withdrawal of this guilty plea so that we can honor our deal. But that deal, they never had the authority, the prosecutor, defense counsel, you cannot seal a record by agreement. That agreement was completely meaningless. You have got to conduct a hearing. The statute is very clear on this point, whether it is post-conviction or post-dismissal.
But your friends on the other side say that there was a hearing. There just wasn't a future hearing. There wasn't a hearing that was set out into the future that would have given the public notice.
Well,
so how would you respond to that?
I'm sorry. There are a couple issues here. I'm still sticking with there was no basis to do the fix. And I don't mean to use that pejoratively, to the correction, because the guilty plea should have stayed in place. There was no, because the sentence had been imposed, and so there was no opportunity to go back and fix it. In fact, the order that was in place was put in place improperly, and that was the status quo. And the idea of allowing this procedure to withdraw a guilty plea after sentence, saying that the manifest injustice to be avoided was this agreement that was improper in the first place,
well,
that
counsel,
can't be manifest injustice.
Yeah, it's similar to a prosecutor and a defendant counsel making an agreement on a recommended sentence, and then it comes time for sentencing, and the judge says, I'm not going to accept that agreement, you know, post-plea, and your client is sentenced to, you know, whatever a greater amount is. And just because the judge sentences to a greater amount of time or punishment is not a basis for a withdrawal of a guilty plea.
I agree 100%, Your Honor. And I think it's even worse in this case because there's a statutory procedure for how you seal the record, which requires a hearing. So the notion that you could agree to seal a record is preposterous. And so
But that was done incorrectly. I mean, the sealing of the record the first time around was admitted that was incorrect.
Well, it was incorrect for a whole host of reasons. It was incorrect because it was done pursuant to an entry that said it was pursuant to 2953.52, which doesn't apply post-conviction. There was no hearing. I mean, not only was it not set for hearing, there was no hearing. It was a paper transaction. The deposition of respondent makes that very clear. There was no adherence whatsoever to the statute. But, Madam Justice, getting back to your question, it was not done properly. We would argue, even putting aside the withdrawal, let's get past the improper withdrawal of the guilty plea, because the matter was not set for hearing. They came in on the 13th. They went through all these machinations to withdraw the guilty plea, and then the prosecutor says, well, guess what? Now we're not going to prosecute. And now respondent judge says, okay, let's do the sealing proceeding right now. It was not set for hearing. Conducting a hearing and setting a hearing are different things. They're set out differently in the statute. We've cited some case law to illustrate that point. You have got to set the matter for a hearing. Setting the hearing and conducting the hearing are two separate things, and we believe that has meaning. Whether it was
so, if the judge is saying, "Well, while you're all here, I'm going to set the hearing," it's going to be 5 minutes from now. Would that comply?
Well, I expected a question like that, Your Honor, and I suppose that's well. I will take the lawyer's cop out. That's a different case, but I do think at least
so
it's better than this case. It's better than this case.
So the trouble here is he didn't say those magic words.
Well, I think the trouble here, Your Honor, that would be splitting hairs. That would be maybe technical compliance. I think as a matter of public policy and justice, that would be not the way to go. But in fact, he didn't even say the magic words here. He just went right off to the races and did it.
Counsel, are you questioning, I'm over here, are you questioning, therefore, the timing of the hearing or the authority of the court to hold the hearing?
In this particular proceeding, the 2012 matter, I do not believe the court at that point had the ability to conduct the hearing.
Why?
The guilty plea should not have been withdrawn.
Well, you're back on that subject. Yeah, I thought we moved away from that. The reality is, as the Chief has indicated, we have withdrawal of guilty pleas all day long in the criminal justice system, correct? And the courts then have to decide whether or not good cause has been shown. You as a newspaper organization, don't have standing to challenge that, do you?
We do believe in this case because it is part and parcel with the sealing process, and we believe it was done to frustrate public access to this record, and it is not good cause. It's to avoid manifest injustice. That is something different. The other larger case.
You believe in that proceeding between the state of Ohio and the defendant that the public has a right to intervene and
I think
be
the
heard?
public has a right to intervene vis-a-vis the sealing order. Outside of that, if there were no sealing issue here, I do not believe we would have the right.
Okay. Counsel, how does the interface with the rules of superintendence affect your position here? I know that you filed a mandamus pursuant to the directive in 47D, which said mandamus is the way that you argue that you are aggrieved in restricting, in public access being restricted.
We believe that if a record is properly sealed, if the statutory requirements are adhered to and a hearing is set, a hearing is conducted properly, evidence is presented, and the court takes into account evidence as to the interest of the defendant and the legitimate needs of the government, then that is a properly sealed record, and it would be exempt from the public access dictates of the rules of superintendence. When that does not happen and there is a record sitting there, then we believe that that record should be made publicly available pursuant to the rules of superintendence. And if it is not, as it was not in this case, then we have the right to proceed, well, any party has a right to proceed with the mandamus action.
So you're not relying in any way upon the rules, the superintendent's rules regarding this, the restriction of public access? You're relying on the statute solely, is that it?
I'm relying on the statute that was not properly adhered to, and therefore the record was not subject to any exemption from production. And so, therefore, if that record was to be withheld, it would need to be withheld pursuant to the rules of superintendence, and that didn't happen in this case either. So there's really no basis for these records.
Is there any authority you have for that position, Mr. Greiner?
For
the position that the record that was sealed pursuant to a statute. In my view, I think the form the court used was citing 52 instead of 32.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is there any authority you have that if there's a clerical error like that, that it's improperly sealed and therefore it's still a public record?
We have cited the Lovelace case from the First District that says an improperly sealed record is subject to collateral attack and is void. The sealing order is void. And
why would a clerical error not be subject to correction?
If the court had
promulgated a form and someone typed the wrong code section in it, and the court has used it without knowledge of that, why would we go back and open up all of those records, which the court and all the parties had thought had been and relied on the fact that those had been sealed properly?
I think there are two facts. We pointed out in our brief that the way to correct a clerical error is through a nunk-pro-tunk entry, which has not been affected in this case, number one. Number two, it goes beyond the clerical error. There's evidence that clearly it was the respondent's practice not to follow the statutory dictates in terms of setting matters for hearing or even conducting hearings.
So you're more concerned with the procedure employed by the court, not necessarily the result?
Correct, Your Honor.
You agree that a sealed record is not a public record?
A properly sealed record is not a public record.
Okay.
I'm about out of my time.
Thank you. Kendall.
May it please the court. My name is Greg Kendall on behalf of Judge Robert Lyons. I will speak for 7 minutes and then yield the balance of my time to Mr. Ferguson. Today we ask this court to deny relator's writ of mandamus and prohibition because the records in question were sealed and remain lawfully sealed pursuant to lawfully issued expungement orders. They are therefore outside the scope of the Public Records Act, and Judge Lyons has no authority to comply, to unseal them, to comply with relator's public records request.
Were they properly sealed?
Yes, Your Honor. With regards to the procedural arguments that relator has made, I'll address those in turn. First of all, Section 32 does not provide a waiting period for the sealing of minor misdemeanors. Although it requires an applicant to wait 1 year for the sealing of a felony and, or excuse me, 1 year for the sealing of a misdemeanor and 3 years for the sealing of a felony, the statute is silent as to a waiting period for minor misdemeanors. Therefore—
And all of the cases here involve minor misdemeanors.
Yes, all the records, or excuse me, relator's objection here, one of the objections being made, is that Judge Lyons sealed these records immediately instead of making the applicant go through the 1 year or 3 year waiting period applicable to felonies and misdemeanors. I want to make clear to the court that when the statute says misdemeanor, that does not also mean minor misdemeanor. A minor misdemeanor is a separate classification of offense under the Ohio Revised Code. Therefore, when the statute fails to provide a separate waiting period for minor misdemeanors, the statute is therefore silent as to a waiting period as to minor misdemeanors, and Judge Lyons therefore had the authority to seal these records of minor misdemeanor convictions immediately.
So without the setting of a hearing, without the establishing that there will be a hearing to deal with this sealing and giving notice then?
Well, Your Honor, a hearing did take place. All these applications for sealing the record take place in open court on the record, and both the state of Ohio, as represented by the Butler County prosecutor, and the applicant for expungement are present at these hearings. Contrary to what Relator has suggested in this case, the hearing requirement has been met here because the statute does not say that the judge must set a future date for a hearing. It only says that, essentially, that a hearing must take place at all.
Except that it does say set a date.
That's correct, Your Honor, but if the judge determines that he will set a date and that date happens to be today's date and the time happens to be 5 minutes from now, that is consistent with the concept of setting a date.
But is that what happened? Is that what happened here? That the court said, I'm going to now set a time even for a hearing?
The problem with answering that question is because all these records are sealed, we don't know exactly what was said on the record or what procedures took place. But common sense would dictate that if there was an issue with timing and the procedures used in the hearing on all these applications for expungements, that the Butler County prosecutor would have raised that objection in that proceeding.
But not necessarily. And aren't we going to be able to see the records?
Your
Presumably.
Honor, well, these records are subject to lawfully issued expungement orders, and the effect of those expungement orders is to prohibit access to those records except in a very narrowly defined list of exceptions. The only exception that applies to judges, in other words, the only exception that allows a judge to access an expunged record, is to open the record to determine an offender's status as a repeat sexual offender. There is no other exception in the expungement statute that allows a judge to access records once they've been lawfully expunged.
If we can go back to the statute for a second about minor misdemeanors, I understand your point that because the statute is silent as to a waiting period for minor misdemeanors, doesn't that mean then that the statute is really silent as to expungement for minor misdemeanors? And if it's not covered, then by what authority would the trial court be able to expunge a minor misdemeanor record at all?
Your Honor, the expungement of minor misdemeanors is a frequent practice in the Butler County Area Court and in the other courts of the state.
But I still need authority for it.
One authority is State v. Weber, cited in our supplemental list of authorities, which held that a minor misdemeanor involving possession of drugs, I believe it was an expungible offense. And the court specifically stated that a minor misdemeanor is an expungible offense in Ohio.
Do you agree with that reading of the statute then? I'm more concerned about what the statute says, and it seems to me illogical to say that there's silence as to a waiting period because the statute doesn't address minor misdemeanors, but to then extrapolate from the statute that you can expunge a minor misdemeanor at all.
The statute also doesn't say that only misdemeanants and felons are entitled to expungement. One only needs to be convicted of a particular crime and meet the eligibility requirements in Section 31A in order to be entitled to an expungement. I'd like to address the other procedural issues involved in this case, specifically the collateral attack and the use of the Public Records Act to bring a collateral attack. As this court explained in Ohio Pyro v. Department of Commerce, collateral attacks on judgments are strongly disfavored, and they're only available in cases where there is lack of subject matter jurisdiction or fraud on the court.
Or there are specific cases in the criminal side where we have expanded that, as you know.
Yes. I'd like to take the opportunity to address Relator's arguments regarding the Leadingham case. Relator has cited this case for the proposition that one can bring a collateral attack to vindicate a pre-existing right of access. The Leadingham case was a 2003 decision of the Fourth District Court of Appeals, and that case preceded this court's decision in Ohio Pyro, as well as the cases of In re JJ and Pratts v. Hurley, which clearly laid out the distinction between subject matter jurisdiction and jurisdiction over particular cases. Ohio Pyro says that the only situations in which a collateral attack on the judgment is available is when there's a lack of subject matter jurisdiction or fraud on the court. I would also like to point out that the Leadingham case cites as a major basis for its opinion the case of Coe v. Erb, which is an 1898 decision of this court. Ohio Pyro actually cited Coe v. Erb in support of its holding that fraud on the court and lack of subject matter jurisdiction are the only circumstances in which collateral attacks apply. So not only does Leadingham, not only was that decision issued without the basis or without the benefit of this court's holding in Ohio Pyro, but Ohio Pyro actually took Leadingham's basis in Coe v. Erb and cited it for the opposite proposition, which is that a collateral attack is disfavored in Ohio and can only be brought when there is a lack of subject matter jurisdiction or fraud on the court. I'd like to
Mr. Kendall, can you address the issue of the statutory section cited by Judge Lyons in the form opinion when these records were sealed, 2953-52 as opposed to 32?
Yes. At every point in this proceeding, Judge Lyons has conceded that that was an error, but the effect of that clerical error is not to render the judgment void ab initio. The effect is to render it voidable. I'd like to defer to Mr. Ferguson for the remaining balance of our time. Thank you.
Justice, may it please the court. I'm Dan Ferguson. I'm representing Judge Lyons on case 12-1924. And at the outset, I want to very quickly point out that 2953.52 is clearly a balancing act between the rights of the defendant, the accused, to a right of privacy and the right of the state to maintain those records. Of course, the Winkler case, which has been cited in some of your briefs, discussed the fact that, part of that right of the state has to do with the newspapers, the public's right to know what's going on in the underlying criminal cases. What's interesting about this particular case, though, is that we have a young man, and you've seen the facts. He committed what can only be described as a reprehensible act, a serious misjudgment in his day-to-day conduct. But as a 14-year prosecutor, I'm hard-pressed to figure out exactly what the criminal charge for that conduct would be. Certainly, he walks into a restroom, he posts a poster, and he puts up on the poster some reprehensible instructions about misconduct. There's a First Amendment issue involved here, and there may be very good reasons why a prosecutor might pursue, upon closer examination, might choose not to pursue the prosecution of a case. So, also, you certainly would have to look at the underlying criminal statute, and you would.
But counsel, isn't that really why I'm more on your right,
yes,
far right?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Isn't that really why we're here today? The problem is, you say that 52 is a balancing act between privacy and the public's right to know. And then in response to Justice French's question, how do we know, as the Supreme Court of Ohio, what went on?
Well, what I'm suggesting, Your Honor, is the facts have been set forth by both sides. The young man went in and he posted this flyer. Now, if the court asks itself, what criminal offense is that, I think anybody sitting on the bench and myself might agree there is no criminal offense. The young man never should have been in front of the court in the first place, quite frankly.
Whose decision is that to make?
Well, that is a prosecutorial decision, Judge. Now, in this particular case, as we know, the defense counsel walked in and said, well, we'll plead guilty to a disorderly conduct and you seal the record, and there was a deal made. And Mr. Griner may be absolutely correct that it may or may not have been a deal that the prosecutor in that area court had the authority to make, but at the point in time when the state could no longer live up to the terms of that deal, Ohio case law is replete with cases that say you have a right to withdraw your plea bargain when the state can't meet the terms of that. So if our assistant prosecutor in the area court made a mistake and entered into a plea, and I'm not stipulating that, but I'm saying if that's the case, and she made a mistake, and she never should have entered into that plea bargain in the first place, because this young man didn't even arguably commit a criminal offense, certainly there's several reasons that manifest injustice would have
been
committed.
Counsel, is this a standard operating procedure for Judge Lyons, prosecutor?
I couldn't answer that, Judge. I've got the facts of this case before me, and I don't practice in front of Judge Lyons' court.
Well, I'm concerned that there's and I don't know whether there's a much utilized practice when it comes to students that Judge Lyons automatically grants a sealing of records.
I'm not sure that we have that in evidence before this court, Your Honor.
So you don't know the answer to that?
I do not.
But isn't that why we're here today?
Well,
public's right to know what's going on in a municipal court in a college town.
Yes, Your Honor. What I'm suggesting is that I would hate to see bad facts make bad law. And we have bad facts here because we have a defendant who should probably have been standing in the position of an uncharged suspect, and the public would have had no right to know in the first place.
But, counsel, my concern, though, is the facts that we have also include a newspaper. And so when you talk about balancing constitutional issues, don't we have also a First Amendment guarantee of free press? And how does that figure into your calculation?
Well, we do, Judge, and Your Honor, and they have a right to know what's going on in the court unless the record's been sealed. And
so the newspaper's rights get cut off once the court seals without any remedy as to whether the sealing of the record was proper?
No, Your Honor, I would not suggest that. I would suggest that the newspaper still has rights to question that sealing. But
how do they do then? In your view, how would that happen?
Well, one thing they can't do, Your Honor, in my opinion, is attack the underlying criminal case.
Let's give you that for the moment.
Okay.
How would they attack it then? What's the proper remedy for a newspaper wanting to get records that have been sealed unsealed?
Well, certainly coming before the court and questioning whether the procedure for 2953.52 have been followed through the writ of mandamus is a proper remedy. I never challenged that in my brief. I actually conceded that and didn't even brief it. We don't disagree with them having a remedy for the improper sealing of records. What we're very, very concerned about and most concerned about is this issue of getting into the underlying criminal case and taking a look at whether or not the judge was within his discretion to unseal a case, to allow the withdrawal of a plea in a case where the plea bargain could no longer be met.
But even if you win on that issue, and we agree with you, that the court did not, either we don't look at that issue or the court didn't abuse its discretion in allowing the withdrawal of the plea, you still have the statutory argument about the procedure itself. So let's say we have, hypothetically, we have a situation where no hearing was held at all. So different case, you would say, I suspect that.
I would.
And here we had a hearing. What if we had no hearing? Would a newspaper be able to challenge that lack of procedure in a mandamus case trying to unseal records? Would that be a proper case?
I would suggest that it probably would, Your Honor, but at the same time, we had a hearing, and it is a different case. We had a hearing. Now, they're trying to read a future requirement into the statute. The word future is not in that statute. The legislature could have said.
What's the purpose of setting a hearing date?
Well, the purpose clearly, and Mr. Greiner briefed this in his brief, the purpose of setting a hearing date is to allow both sides, the state and the defendant, to brief the case.
Because you're presuming that this is only a conversation with the court by two parties, the prosecutor and the defense attorney, and you're not acknowledging that the people, and I know you say the prosecutor represents the people, but the right of the press to be informed of what is happening in a courtroom, I think, is indisputable. Do you not agree?
I agree with that, Your Honor.
So if you set a hearing, and here there's no indication that a hearing was set, it was just done, but the theory is you set a hearing so all of these individuals who have a constitutional right can take advantage of that, can exercise that.
Your Honor, if the legislature wanted to impose upon the court a requirement for a future hearing, they could have said the hearing shall take place not less than 10 days hence. They didn't do that. They could have said you have an obligation, Judge, to post a public notice of this so that the newspaper knows when it's going to. They didn't say that either. What they said was set a hearing. He had a hearing. The prosecutor was there. The prosecutor, and the reason that the case law has set for having a hearing is it so both sides can brief the issue. The prosecutor was there. Certainly the inquirer was not going to have the obligation or the ability to brief this issue.
Counsel, the this all took place in the normal course of a normal court date, did it not?
I believe it did, Your Honor.
Yeah, I mean, this wasn't some meet me at the courthouse at midnight kind of deal.
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor.
Okay, so the court's open, and any media of any kind can set through all of the proceedings, and if they undertook the effort to come that day when this transpired, they'd be there for the hearing.
That is absolutely correct, Your Honor.
In our rules of superintendence, when we talk about restricting public access to a court document, we also state that there shall be a hearing and notice shall be given to all parties in the case, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. If that is the procedure that's being used, it was simply not the procedure in this case. It was a 2953.5.
But again, the superintendent's rules don't put an obligation on the court to specifically notify the press.
No, they do not.
Restrictions.
I'd like to ask just a quick factual question. What effect, if any, here should we give the fact that the prosecutor, after the motion to withdraw the plea was granted, sua sponte said we're not asking for a continuance? Could that be an acknowledgement that there should be a hearing set?
Well, I think it's probably an acknowledgement that the prosecutor is the one with the standing representing the people to object to the hearing proceeding at this point in time, and the prosecutor chose not to because she had nothing she particularly wanted to brief about this thing. Prosecutor had no objection to the sealing of the record, and let's go back again to the fact that the reason she might not have had that objection is the fact that perhaps this young man shouldn't have been in front of the courts in the first place on criminal charges.
So if the press were interested in prosecutorial discretion and how it's being used in a particular county, there are methods for the press to get that information by sitting in the courtroom and watching what happens.
Absolutely.
Rather than getting specific notice on a specific case.
Absolutely, and I will also suggest that their methods to inquire into prosecutorial discretion go beyond that. They call our office all the time and ask questions, and we're happy to sit with them.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Greiner, you have about a minute and a half.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would urge the court to look at respondent's deposition, which is part of the record. The deal was not discussed in public. With all due respect, Justice Pfeiffer, it was a private meeting in chambers, and they emerged, and it was done. So there was no notice to the public whatsoever about what was going to happen,
you referred to the deal. We're here dealing with what transpired on the record.
But there was absolutely no notice to the public or the press or anyone about what was going to happen.
But if the Inquirer had bothered to send a reporter to sit there in court, they would have seen this all happen.
They would have seen it unfold.
Which is, for many of us who prosecuted at one time, it was not uncommon to have the reporter sitting there all day long watching everything you did.
There's absolutely no notice that this was going to happen at this time. Well, and there was very little. The dealing was done.
In any busy court, a lot of things happen.
I understand,
Your Honor. And they aren't all on the docket when the court starts that morning. You have paperwork backed up from here to Cincinnati if judges couldn't keep moving things and saying, counsel's all here, are you ready to proceed? Let's move on and do the next thing.
I understand, Your Honor. With respect to the misdemeanor issue, Justice French, because time's short, I would urge you to look at pages 5 to 7 of our reply brief that addresses that issue in great detail. I would also note that the Weber case was decided before the current language. The language of the statute was amended post-Weber. So Weber really doesn't apply to this case because it was dealing with significantly different statutory language.
So I assume that your position would be that because the statute is silent as to minor misdemeanors, that doesn't just apply to a waiting period. It means that minor misdemeanors are not subject to expungement at all.
Well, I believe respondent is really trying to have it both ways. In the 2953.31 definition of eligible offender, the statute specifically says that minor misdemeanors are not convictions for purposes of this division. And then 32 says that there will be a 3-year waiting period for a felony and a 1-year period waiting period for a misdemeanor. Now, either misdemeanor encompasses minor misdemeanor, that when the use of misdemeanor encompasses minor misdemeanors, so that minor misdemeanors can come into this statute, and therefore they are subject to the 1-year waiting period, or minor misdemeanants are not subject to this statute at all. It's got to be one or the other, because the statute, when it talks about the various convictions, it talks about an eligible offender with a felony. You're not eligible if you have more than one felony conviction. You're not eligible if you have more than 2 misdemeanor convictions. The very next sentence says minor misdemeanors are not convictions under this statute. Well, if a minor misdemeanor is a completely separate classification, that language is superfluous. There'd be no reason for it. So it must mean something. But again, we do a pretty detailed explanation at pages 5 to 7.
Mr. Greiner, before you sit down, I'm still fascinated by your suggestion that something was wrong when the judge said, I want to see both counsel in my chambers. Are you suggesting if your reporter had been in the courtroom that day and the judge said, I want to see counsel in chambers, that the reporter's entitled to go in there and see what they're talking about?
No, Your Honor, but I am suggesting that that is not very good notice. I mean, to say that this all took place, in the sunlight, I think is a bit of an overstatement. That's my only point.
Well, it what we're talking about here all ultimately took place on the record with a court reporter or a recording system.
It did, although there is nothing in the record that demonstrates any evidence presented as to what the interests of the defendant were to support the sealing of the record. There is nothing in this record. There is a record of the hearing, and I have found no evidence presented in that hearing whatsoever. I see statements from counsel. I see statements from the prosecutor. I see statements from the defense counsel, but I see no evidence.
But that was all done in open court.
That was done in open court, but there's no evidence.
Thank you.
And if I just capsulize what your argument is, it's procedural, that the wrong statute was used in the court's form and no notice was given.
Yes, Your Honor, and one more point.
Pardon me, please?
And I'm sorry, there's one more point. That is, if you look at the record, or you look at the affidavit from Attorney Staton that was presented in behalf of respondent, and he presents his standard sealing entry, and if you look at the sealing entry that was used on the November 7th date, it is apparent that no hearings were conducted, that this was simply done by paper entry.
So you think the proceeding that Justice Pfeiffer was talking about in the court was not a hearing?
No, I think that was a hearing, but I think that was the exception. The rule was there were no hearings, that the papers were submitted, and that was it. I think the record will demonstrate that.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision.